This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is breadboxmedia.com. How you doing? This is Chuck Coughlin, yes. And I'm continuing our reflections on the secret archives of the Vatican, a very exciting subject based on a book that I discovered in the University of Kentucky Library, The Secret Archives of the Vatican, by Maria Luisa Ambrosini. And I, of course, bought the book, got it from Amazon, and I'm sharing little fillets of it. I'm carefully selecting little fillets to cut out and present to you, and adding some more material from some of the other sources I have, Will Durant, etc. I want to say again, secret archives, it's not secret. Secret in an ancient sense of the word secret is the private archives of the popes, actually. This is the fourth program in a series on the archives. There'll be more. And in the last program, we talked about the white barbarians. We're talking about the invasions and sacking of Rome, how the Goth Alaric was marching on Rome, impelled by a demon. He said, "There was always someone behind me that torments me, pushing me and cries to me, 'Go on, go on, destroy Rome.'" And he was followed by Attila the Hun, who did turn back, perhaps because of the persuasion of the Pope. And then the Vandals came and liberated the seven-branch golden candlesticks that the Romans had looted from the Temple of Solomon. Give you an idea of the treasures that have been lost. Because it was lost then, it vanished. And of course, the invasion shocked and bewildered the Catholic world. Everyone asked the perennial question, why does God permit such things to happen to good people? Why do bad things happen to good people? And whereas the basilicas were spared and the sacred buildings were spared, the archives were not, because often the disadvantage of the books or the codexes was that they had covers, and the covers were bedecked with precious jewels. So those were prized out, and the contents of the books often just thrown away. The texts of some 5th century documents have come down to us because they had been sent as messages to other cities, and so they were preserved in the archives of local bishops. But most of the archives for the first 12 centuries were lost one way or another. 95-99% of it was lost. Things were in chaos. Rome had fallen and soon after 470. And it seemed that the sound principle of authority that had been represented by the Roman imperial government had vanished in the West. Now, Pope Leo, as Bishop of Catholic Rome, demonstrated the qualities of power and dignity, though he humbly said that the Pope is more happy to serve than to occupy the chair of St. Peter. He also claimed the title of custodian of the traditional doctrine and proclaimed his, quote, solicitude for all churches, implying the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church, the one in Rome. Now we have some sermons of Leo. Now one of these sermons, it's a story of a trial, and the account reflects both his deep concern for the subject at hand. And his excellent juridical background, his legal background, is the account of his inquiry into what he called, quote, the perverted and magic sexualism, unquote. Yes, that's what he called it, the perverted and magic sexualism of the Manichaeans. Many of the Manichaean sects had fled to Italy from the Vandal invasions in North Africa and Rome. And there was a Manichaean community of considerable size in Rome. The papal document the Vatican would now call an official discourse. It dealt with his investigation into a charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, in a rite designed to demonstrate that the soul is not stained by the action of the body. A young boy and a young girl, who were both sexually innocent, had been placed together. They were not given any clothes to wear, and they were observed. And they wanted to watch, and the Manichaeans wanted to observe them, to observe that their soul was not affected by the sins of the body, by the pleasures of the body. So Pope Leo made a record of the trial, and he wrote about it. This is what he wrote. They were with me as judges, bishops, and priests. and also the laymen of the aristocracy. We ordered that the elect men and women of these Manichaeans be brought to us. There came to judgment, in fact, all the persons who had perpetrated the infamous crimes. That is, a girl no more than 12 years of age and two women who were governesses had arranged the crime. Also summoned to come testify was the boy who had had intercourse with the girl. They also called the Manichaean bishop who had arranged this crime. Now let me remind you at this point what Manichaean means. It's a dualistic religious system named after Manus, and it was a combination of Gnostic Christianity, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, and various other elements. But its basic doctrine was a conflict between matter and spirit, body and soul, light and dark. Matter and the body was regarded as dark and evil. The evil of the body existed in a strong polarity with the innocence and virtue of the soul. It was a strong polarity. They had them testify separately. All their confessions were identical. In the document, Pope Leo wrote, "In order not to offend your chaste feeling by speaking openly, we refer you to the documents of their actions, which shows that in their sect, the Manichaean sect, there is only lying, a demonic cult, and rites of turpitude." Unquote. Why do we have this record? Well, transcriptions of this trial of the Manichaeans were sent to the bishops of Italy and to the rest of the Catholic world. And the Manichaean books were burned. So even the Catholic Church burns books, the books of heretics. To give you an idea of the various contents of the archives, I want to describe several of the books, maybe about 9 other books, and we'll talk about each one. The first book that can still be found in the secret archives of the Vatican is entitled The Acts of the Martyrs. Unfortunately, this book is just a small fragment. This was a voluminous collection of books, actually. But somewhere in these troubled centuries, the Acts of the Martyrs, except for one small book, disappeared. We know there were tens of thousands of martyrs under the Diocletian and Neronian persecutions. It is a tragedy, for often the accounts of the Acts of the Martyrs were a great tool for evangelization and to inspire the faithful, to remind them how much their fellow Catholics valued the faith. But almost all of that is gone. Pope Gregory the Great, around 600, explicitly said in his time the Acts of the Martyrs no longer existed except for this single book. Private enterprise seems to have provided substitute reading matter, for at the end of the 5th century, a list of books to be accepted and not to be accepted was drawn up. This list, possibly a private compilation, is usually called by historians Decretum Ceslasianum. It has survived through a contemporary copy made by an Italian or provincial priest, perhaps. You can think of it as a forerunner of the Index of Forbidden Books. As I said, the title was a list of books to be accepted and not to be accepted. Now, today, we don't like the idea of banned books. Well, perhaps it's because we don't take the media seriously enough. Everyone worries about the effect of material out on the Internet having on our youth, and it does have a great effect. The effect of the media is extraordinarily powerful on human consciousness. And in these early centuries, writing was extraordinarily powerful. And one of my favorite propositions is that our culture is dying of bad music. I'm a musician, and I have witnessed the effect that music has on the mental processes of people. It bypasses their rationality. It enters the landscape of their emotions and their soul. Well, words do the same. If in our time we think it's worth funding public libraries because of the good the books will do, why do we discount the harm that the wrong books can do? In a quite different way, they do pass through the rationality, but they can misinform. People in past centuries took heresy seriously. Who was wrong? Were they wrong or are we wrong? We allow heresy to go unrestricted, sometimes almost totally unopposed. In our society, in our culture, are collapsing around us, are decaying, are decomposing. I personally witnessed the great harm that the book The Da Vinci Code did to so many people I know. I believe it destroyed the faith of many Christians, of many Catholics. So let's not be too critical of the Catholics in these early centuries, because they were having to fight for the truth. And yes, the Catholic Church did suppress heretical books. And it forbade the reading of certain stories of the Roman martyrs because the names and characters of their authors were not known. Also forbidden were apocryphal books and all heretical and superstitious writings. Now, one of my purposes talking to you today is to give you an idea of what kind of stuff it is that they were stored in the Vatican secret archives. Well, we have some fragmentary ideas, don't we? And so after the break, I'm gonna list a collection of books that we do know, 9 or 10 different ones, there were or are in the archives that are very interesting. The contents is very interesting. That's why I call it the stuff that's in the secret archives. So this is breadboxmedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and we're setting the record straight and opening up the record just for you, for your enlightenment, and I hope for your delight. Be back after the break. While you're on our website, breadboxmedia.com, why don't you click on Bless the Yes? You may be very glad you did. You're listening to a guitarist and a harpsichordist together. The guitarist is the great Julian Bream. The music is by Bach.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
On breadboxmedia.com, this is Setting Records Straight with Chuck Coughlin. And before the break, we were talking about the good that books do and the harm that books do, because our subject is the contents, the stuff in the secret archives of the Vatican. And this is the fourth Setting the Straight program on the subject of the contents of the secret archives of the Vatican, which are really the private archives of the popes, right? Not secret at all. Plenty of scholars have access to them. But has it all been looked at? No. There's vast quantities of documents that have not been organized or even opened. But I promised you before the break that we'd talk about some of the books that are not good for us, some of the heretical books, and we're going to talk about that now. Among the books condemned as apocryphal were the Gospels, supposedly by Matthew, Barnabas, James, Peter, and Thomas. These were being used by the Manichaeans. Perhaps you've heard of those Gospels. I've seen them in public libraries today. They're back with us. These books confuse the faithful. I'm not for destroying them, but these books will and have destroyed the faith of many. They're fine for someone who has a firm foundation in the Catholic faith, in their correct accounts of the Gospels. So the Catholic Church at this time, in those early centuries, was very concerned that if they did include the stories of martyrs, that they were authentic stories, not the fantasies and fairy tales of imaginative people.
Also, there was the Book of the Nativity of the Savior and of Mary, or the Book of the Obstetrician, the book about the daughters of Ada called Genesis, the Cento of Christ composed of the verses of Virgil, Ogia, a book about the biblical giant who fought with a dragon after the deluge. The Physiologist was another one, written by heretics and attributed to the Blessed Ambrose. But it wasn't true. The pamphlets of Tertullian and the writings of Simon the Magician. All of these books were declared damned for eternity, along with their authors and the followers of their authors.
Papyrus scrolls of the Gospels of Thomas and Peter were rediscovered in Egypt in just this past century and seem to have been written from the viewpoint of the Gnostic and Docetist heresies.
You know, you want to regret the loss of such books, not only because their titles would make one reach for them on a rack of paperbacks, and the gaudy covers of some of them would have made you reach for them also. But the real reason is because modern scholarship can learn facts even from false books. That's sort of like the psychiatrists, who sometimes learn a lot from the lies their patients tell them, because that reveals sometimes much more. Now, one of the earliest documents in the secret ark to come down to us in its physical form is an act of donation to the Pope by Romanized Goth.
Yes, by Romanized Goth. It was called an act of donation. Now, what's a Romanized Goth? It's someone who hasn't come to invade Rome, but come to settle there, become a farmer, raise his sons, speaking Latin. He wanted his children to be brought up in the elegant civilization of the Romans, and to become a Roman. There were vast numbers of these Goths that did exactly that. We know the stories of the great invasion and the pillaging and the sacking of Rome, but those were singular events, marked boldly in history. But this steady immigration and settling in to become Roman happened every day, all day. They were immigrants, coming from a primitive civilization into the comfort of an advanced one. They had aqueducts, running water, fresh fountains, flush toilets, concrete, wonderful roads. Why not? So a Goth like that wrote this book.
This book escaped destruction. Why? Because it was hidden in a very small church near Tivoli. The date of the book is 471, but its story begins in the previous century. In the year 359, there had died a great gentleman of this Rome that was going down to its tragic sunset. The consul Junius Bassus, prefect of the city, was who it was. He was only 42 years of age, and he was buried in a sarcophagus that is a masterpiece of the time. You can find it now in the Vatican Grotto. It is covered with bas-relief scenes from the scriptures. The central one shows Christ between the apostles, Peter and Paul. Now, at first, you might think the scene has been misinterpreted, and it actually represents the boy Jesus in the temple. For the Christ appears as being a very young adolescent. Then you might notice another scene.
It's a scene of Palm Sunday, Christ entering the East Gate.
But here again, Christ is shown in that as a young boy.
Then you start to realize what the artist was depicting. That the artist was not seeing Christ as a historical figure, but as a divine child of a deity. Well, this depiction was on the sarcophagus of the very rich Junius Bassus. And he had built at his own expense what is now the Piazza del Santa Maria Maggiore, the last secular basilica of Roman times, as an auditorium for public meetings and political ceremonies. 50 years later, the invading Goths took over the basilica, and in the aristocratic palace of Junius Bassus, a barbarian chief, we don't know his name, installed himself after killing or evicting the owners. It was in this place that the son of that usurper grew up, the young Flavius Vatila, called Theodoric. So let's talk about Theodoric. He had Roman taste and spirit, but he had the Germanic love of war and of weapons. He was said to be the head of the two armies, Gothic and Roman, and he called himself illustrious consul and count of the palace. All of this wealth acquired by violence may have weighed on his conscience, or he may have feared another barbarian invasion in which he himself might be killed or evicted from his property. So now we come to the donation, years 571. This young man decided to donate his property to the Pope, to Pope Simplicius, and to retire to a villa near Tivoli, which he'd also taken by force. Now, this is a financial document, but very revealing. And as I said, many historians love to research financial documents. One of my very favorite historians is the French archivist Régis Pernod, who revealed a lot of our misconceptions about the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages by studying financial documents. So this financial document, called his Act of Donation, gives a picture of the life of the times. And we have the words of Theodoric in his dedication of the Act of Donation.
listen to Theodoric, so that those who offer divine services may have a local support, may have a local source of support, and the temple of the divine religion be adorned with chandeliers, and for the repair of the roof, with our wealth we will pay all expenses. May our homage serve as a propitiation to God. Then Theodoric goes on to list some farms with very colorful names, but I just sense that this list may be a bit too long for this program and for you and for me, who might not want to listen to it all. But some of it's really interesting, and it starts out with a list of farms that tells us a bit about the times. And of course, it included the livestock and the human livestock. Here's a little fillet from the list. The farm of Mount Paternus, the farm of the House of Mars, the farm of Green Things. Now listen to this. The Basilian farm, with the exception of Sigiloso, daughter of Anastasius and Apica, farmers whom we keep and will keep in our own right. Theodoric also gave the church the land it is built on and an adjoining lot for orchard, a residence for priests. He then offers farms in the Tivoli area. Reserving to myself the usufruct during my lifetime and giving the property to the said Catholic Church. Maybe you've been noticing that they do talk about the Catholic Church in these early centuries. Yes, they do talk about the Catholic Church. Ever since about the year 100, our beloved church had that name. And it's my personal inclination not to talk about the early Christian martyrs, but to talk about the early Catholic martyrs. I noticed a tendency among some of my friends and associates that needs to be steered correctly again by setting the record straight. Some of my Protestant friends seem to have evoked a great fog over the early centuries about who was really around at that time. It's innocuous and helpful just to watch the little words we use in our conversations. These people were not the early Christians. They were the early Catholics. Now the inventory of Theodoric's very generous donation goes on. And then there follows a list of objects, silver and gold, chalices, lusters, censers, vases, so on, including two small silver doors for the confessional with their little keys. He also gave the following books. Now we come to the books. Four Gospels, the Acts of the Apostles, the Psalter, and a lectionary. Now, the presence of only a few books in this long inventory of rich objects and magnificent farmlands and human livestock can be explained by the fact that books at the time were rare and precious treasures. The Babylonians had used the earth itself to write on. The Babylonians wrote with a stylus, and they had a system that made possible rapid transcription free from the inaccuracies of individual handwriting. Now, in the West, we had adopted materials and methods that made the wide dissemination of documents so expensive as to be almost impossible until the invention of paper and then the invention of printing. Now, this document, this donation, in the original version belonging to the secret archives, could still be read in the 12th century when a transcription was made. The original itself is completely decomposed. It's like sand. Yes, we're all going to return to dust. I have to face that, and as I turn around and look at my toppling towers of books here in my high barn studio, I see that it's all going to go to dust. And thank God I've got this medium. I'm putting it out there for a while, folks. I'll be back after the break. I'm Chuck Coughlin for a while here on BreadboxMedia.com, trying to set the record straight before it's too late.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Chuck Coughlin back after the break. So glad to see you're still there. So let's see, where were we? We're talking about the stuff that's in the secret Vatican archives.
And we've reflected on what's not there, and most of it is not there. The treasurable documents that were created and recorded of the proceedings of the church, and perhaps some of the epistles of the apostles themselves. Before the 12th or 13th century, most of it's been destroyed, lost, pillaged, sacked, burned. The Catholic Church goes on with our robust tradition and with our great adherence to reason and honesty. In addition to an ardent faith, we self-check. We eliminate what is erroneous. In those times called heresy, not a popular word anymore, we eliminate what is erroneous. Very important to do. That's what science does too. The Catholic Church is all over the globe. It is Catholic. Over 1.1 billion, what is it, 1.2 billion by now? And the truth is alive in all of the members of the Catholic Church. What a big help it would be in our evangelization if we had all these works and writings from the apostles and the generations after that. Thank God we have some fragments. We do. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So after 500 years of experience of losing things, losing valuable documents, the popes of the late 5th and early 6th centuries sponsored the compilation of summaries. And this is one of the books I'm going to talk about. The Book of the Canon and the Book of the Popes, the Liber Canonum and the Liber Pontificalis. Now, the Liber Canonum is in the secret archives. The latter has been transferred to the Vatican Library, the Book of the Popes, Liber Pontificalis. Now, we talked about Theodoric, the barbarian king. He had a brain trust, and among the people in that brain trust was a monk, Dionysius Exiguus, little old Dionysius. He was one of the leading intellectuals of Rome, friend of Cassiodorus and Boethius. He's the one that compiled the Book of Canons, the Liber Canonum, a collection of church law based on the Acts of the Eastern Synods. To it, he added a collection of papal decrees, later called the Liber Decretorum. Pope Adrian revised and extended this book in the 8th century. And as the Collectio Dionysio Hadriana, the collection of Dionysius and Hadrian, it was accepted by Charlemagne, became part of Carolinian law. That's Charlemagne's law. Carolinian law. And for centuries was the primary legal source in Italy, in Gaul, and in Christian Africa. We know what happened later if you've listened to some of my other programs on how the Catholic Church is the basis of our laws today. It came from the canon law. It wasn't the 1000 that it was formalized. In an amazing concordance that melded together the laws of all kingdoms and entities, the monk that did that created international law. And the UN is his child. But let's talk about the Book of the Popes. It's a series of short papal biographies from St. Peter on, compiled by an anonymous cleric about the middle of the 6th century. So it drew on all these other sources that they were afraid would be lost, that they were afraid would be lost or destroyed. So it was a summary. And by making a summary that was compact enough, it could be copied, and the copies could be distributed widely. Think of it as a distant remote backup of the data, an iCloud of the past. So these were fairly condensed papal biographies. It drew on the accounts of earlier authors. It was carried forth and added on to by other writers through the Avignon period, with an eclipse for the dark 9th century. Well, some of the information that does survive in these condensed biographies is rather tantalizing. How long was Peter Pope, do you know? Was it for a short time? Listen to the short bio of St. Peter, the first pope. Blessed Peter, apostle and prince of apostles, man of Antioch, son of John, of the province of Galilee, in the vicinity of Bethesda, brother of Andrew, first sat in the episcopal chair in Antioch 7 years. Then Peter entered into the city of Rome, Nero being Caesar, where he sat in the episcopal chair 25 years, 3 months, and 3 days. It was he who transmitted the power to bind and loose. So how long was Peter Pope? 7 years plus 25 years.
That's 32 years, 3 months, and 3 days. Well, I never knew that before. That was a rather long papacy. And the depictions of St. Peter as a gray-haired old man, largely bald, probably are something like he looked toward the end of his papacy. And we're sure he was a young man when he was there by the shoreline. And the Son of God walked up to him. What a moment that was. So these short biographies, with their interesting, curious information, sometimes legend-like, sometimes partisan, are an important source for the history of Rome in the Middle Ages. In them, we read of the rise of the deaconates, which distributed to the poor the goods that had been donated to the church. We read of Calixtus building the first basilica in Trastevere. We learned about gifts, such as a golden cross for St. Peter's tomb, with the inscription, Constantinus Augustus et Helena Augusta have adorned this royal house. The Emperor Constantine and his mother adorned this royal house, the tomb of Peter. A golden crown was there, stormed with precious stone from an Ostrogoth king. And what else? Justinian's cross, containing splinters of the cross of Christ, the true cross that Helena had uncovered in the Holy Land. So of all those precious things, what did we have left? One thing, one precious thing. Oh, we have Justinian's cross, thank God, containing the splinters of the cross of Christ. So what other kind of information is there? There's other things. There's records of pilgrimages, descriptions of hospices. You can get a feeling for the building that was always going on in Christian Rome. And in the Book of the Popes, we learn something of the documents contained in the scrinium of the church. At the time when its first editors were at work, the papal archives still showed the wounds of the barbarian invasions. The references to archives documents are limited to a very small number of original texts. There were a lot of copies. The Vatican Library has a 9th century volume of the Book of the Popes, bound in red leather, written in the clear, efficient Carolinian script. Its ink still iridescently black. On its cover in gold are two coats of arms, those of Queen Christina of Sweden and those of Pope Alexander VIII, who bought her library. You gotta say, wow, what great stuff is in the secret archives. There's another compendium, really interesting one, the Book of the Days, the daily book, Liber Diurnus. It's kept in a separate case. It's written on parchment in a beautiful Lombard script. It was compiled sometime before the 9th century and contains documents that go back to the 4th century. This daily book, so-called because it was needed every day, was a book of formulas or models for the chancellery to use in composing papal acts and messages. So it served as a kind of reference law book. It was like a book of good examples of letters and documents, a template for them. Some of the documents go back to the 4th century in that, too. Like these letters for all occasions, books of the 19th century, the Liber Diurnus included examples. And this is its interest for the historian, since the 117 documents that it quotes as models give a lively picture of the life and thinking of the Lateran Patriarch, especially for the century of St. Benedict. Oh, we're going to talk a little bit about St. Benedict in a few minutes. And you find lists of furnishings, human and otherwise, of Roman hospitals around the 6th century. It talks about doctors, beds, mattresses, linen, thermal baths, olive oil, fats, meat dishes. We learn that boy slaves were habitually used for the service of the sick, and that the doctors of the times anticipated the modern treatment of tender, loving care by ordering attendants not to wait for the sick to ask for help, but to give help before it was asked for. Yes, there's documents dealing with slavery in the church, though it's written in a humanitarian vein. The monasteries did use slaves for agriculture and domestic work. There are various formulas for the donation of slaves, for their exchange between monasteries, for their manumission, in other words, their liberation, sometimes done in a church ceremony. In one of the model documents, the abbot of a monastery informs the Pope that a serf of his monastery intends to marry a slave woman attached to the pontifical patrimony. and asks the Pope if he may give him another slave as a substitute. Permission is granted.
There's even a model prayer from this daily book that is still in use.
It's a formula for a prayer that is said by bishops in dedicating new churches, which reflects the times when monasteries and churches had a place for strangers. They had a separate place
for those that were on the road. Perhaps they were pilgrims, perhaps just wayfarers.
Pilgrims were sheltered there. Listen to what it says, and it's still used. May you always abundantly enjoy this happiness of quiet, this grace of hospitality.
What a beautiful thing. With that lovely thought, let's take a break. Like when you've eaten a particularly delicious bite, just stop eating for a while and savor the aftertaste of it.
May you always abundantly enjoy this happiness of quiet, this grace of hospitality on BirdBoxMedia.com.
Chuck Coughlin's setting the record straight about the magnificent history of our beloved Catholic Church. Be back.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Coughlin back again. So let's go on a bit. This is a delicious subject. We're going to talk about calligraphy because that's very important in dating and identifying documents. And because of its importance, attached to the Vatican Secret Archives is a school of the study of documents, the study of paleography, the old writing. And this helps us in looking at these documents, because so many of them were copied in the monastery scriptoria. The laboriousness of hand copying is usually given as the reason for the scarcity of books in the Middle Ages. Yet books were plentiful in Imperial Rome, in Byzantium, and in Islam, and in all these cultures they were copied by hand. If the labor of hand copying was not the reason for the scarcity of books, what was? The expense of materials? Or simply that people in a non-reading society didn't care enough to copy them? Well, about 1/10 of the people were literate, though. In the Roman Empire, that was 75 million. Well, possibly one reason for the scarcity of books was the inefficiency of some of the copyists. But a sculptured plaque showing St. Gregory and three of his scribes suggests that the scriptoria may have sometimes lacked convenient working equipment. Gregory himself is writing on a book held on a lectern. But three scribes have no lectern desk or table to write on. One of them seems to be writing on a lap board, but is holding a cornucopia-shaped container of ink in one hand while he writes with the other. The other two have nothing to support the books in which they're writing. Another reason must have been that the codices, the books, were often regarded as works of art rather than a means of communication. Illuminating a missal with pictures in color and gold leaf could take almost any amount of time that one was willing to give to it. Elaborate bindings added to the expense. You see, books were often bound in gold, silver, or ivory plates, studded with precious stones. We've mentioned that. The parchment, expensive in itself, might be dyed purple, and ink was sometimes, especially in Charlemagne's time, made of gold. Such codices were less books than works of art to ornament a church or monastery. Even in more modest transcriptions, it may be that more attention was paid to the regularity of lettering than was necessary for the sake of readability. So this high cost made purchase impractical. The monasteries and most important bishop seats copied their own books just as they baked their own bread. Books were exchanged. Rare copies were lent for transcribing. So let's talk a bit about these scriptoria. One of them set up by St. Benedict at Monte Cassino, and it became famous. Well, Monte Cassino had been in a place where a fortress, a pagan temple, overlooked a green valley. This is where Benedict built his monastery and his sister Scholastica her convent, where she ruled as abbess until her death. We have a quote from her
Brother, do not leave me alone this night. Go on talking to me about eternal life. But Benedict has a greater monument than this magnificent Monte Cassino. Unfortunately, so much destroyed by Allied troops during World War II. The greater monument is the Holy Rule. The Holy Rule of Benedict. It was a sensible and working constitution for communal living, under which men could survive and be useful, instead of torturing themselves as some had in the desert saints, the ascetics. So they practiced moderation in their self-denial. The practicality, the detail, and the foresight of Benedict's rule are apparent in his writing. The Benedictine monasteries were economically self-sufficient, sealed cities, capable of withstanding the siege of the world. The city of God was to be an enclave. St. Benedict said the monastery should be built in such a way that within its walls are all that is necessary to life. That is, water, meal, an orchard, the oven, the shops of different kinds of artisans, the library for the books to be read and studied, the scriptorum for the transcriptions of books necessary for spiritual culture. Now, the Benedictine rule did not particularly stress the transcription of books, but by requiring their use in a time they were expensive, it made it necessary. Listen to Benedict. Laziness is the enemy of the soul. Therefore, the monks must perform manual labor at certain hours, and at certain other hours they must read the sacred books. Reading was equated with fasting. And in fasting periods, Benedict said this: during fasting periods, each one must take a book from the library and read it in an orderly manner, beginning at the beginning. He didn't want you skipping around in the books, of course. The copy of the Rule of Benedict that was sent to Rome has been lost, but we can follow the story that was kept by the monks of Monte Cassino. When the monastery was looted by the Lombards, the monks fled to Rome, taking with him this original copy of the rule. It had been written by the saint himself. This copy of the rule, written by Saint Benedict, was placed in the papal archives. It remained there right up to 742, when Pope Zachary gave it back to Monte Cassino. However, about a century later, the monks had to flee again before invaders. The Muslims this time, the Saracens they were called. They took the manuscript with them to Tiano on the way to Naples. But there was a surprise attack, and the manuscript was burned to ashes. Only a single fragment of it was saved. This fragment was revered as a relic and brought back to Monte Cassino when peace was established. But the troubles weren't over. In the Napoleonic Wars, even this very last fragment of parchment, written by the hand of Benedict himself, was lost. Benedict wasn't the only one that established monastery, writing factories, scriptoria. There was Cassiodorus, who had built his life around the concept of civilitas, the rule of law. The Roman Empire had fallen, but what it stood for could still survive: the roads, the aqueducts, and the rule of law. Now, Cassiodorus, I mentioned him a little earlier in the program. He served that barbarian king, Theodoric, as a secretary of state. And he nearly made a civilized ruler out of Theodoric. But when that dynasty fell, Cassiodorus returned to his family estates in southern Italy. He was old then. Everyone thought he'd come home to die. The dream of the civility, the rule of law, was still with him. So he founded two monasteries, Vivarium and Castellum. He had a practical purpose in making Vivarium into an ecclesiastical summer resort. It was a beautiful place. He wanted his monastery to be sought by other people rather than other places. He wanted a happy staff and low turnover. What he had in mind was nothing less than saving pagan literature and science for the Christian world. The legalization of Christianity and the fact that it had become a state religion had brought into the church men of deep culture. The patristic writings have class. They make most of the religious writing of later periods look, in a literary sense, sort of careless writing. They had class. And of course, it wasn't only the Italians. The Irish had great scriptura and a tradition of copying books. They produced the most magnificent of all, the Book of Kells. If I won't embarrass myself, I'd like to read you a poem I wrote about it, about St. Peter materializing in an Irish scriptorium in the middle of the night. So here it is. It's called St. Peter and His Great Book. Sometimes as I lay swaddled in slumber, I hear someone from somewhere far away
humming Palestrina. It drifts to me down my tower, quiet as dust sifting from silent bells. Often my own prudent little diary is still lying open by my bedside, the day's harvest peeled and corn fresh on the open page. The page will be turned and closed forever, for I travel on and on into new sleeps. I go on to work on my night shift in bed, shepherding chimerical night herds, taking them to graze the mountain sides of my gyri and sulci. Above us, the belly of the universe glistens, above and away and away. Dimly I hear at times, beyond the whispering pistons of all our breathing, the scratch of a pen on a parchment, an absent-minded humming of the old chants, echoing down from a celestial abbey. It sounds as if some monk is still awake, copying the dear verses in the scriptorium. I saw long ago that it is not a monk that writes and hums along. As we sleep, a mighty surf scrolls from his hand, recording our deeds forever, made immortal now, rendered in the calligraphy he practiced and masters after centuries of appearing in Irish monasteries, materializing to contemplate and imitate the illuminations of the master scribes. I have seen that he is no monk. No, it is Saint Peter that comes here to record our stories in his great book. He appears after the monks have gone off to chant the compline before falling into exhausted sleep upon their pallets. They give the labor of their lives to copy the scriptures so all have a chance to know them. As they fall asleep, Saint Peter hears their thoughts, and as is his duty, records them in his great book. And so what are the monk's thoughts? Every day work and pray, not much play, just work and pray. Just ora et labora day after day, even on Sunday pray before we play. Too much ora et labora for this hearty Irish boy. So faith in Begorra, whence springs this joy? Devotion fires the saint to write on through the night, humming Palestrina, as he softens his visions of our grievous offenses, and with occasional call for St. Paul's aid with an elegant phrase. Good St. Peter waxes eloquent over our mea maxima culpas. Paternal Peter shapes his letters into florets and pheasants in flight, describing the sweet deeds we sow over the fence to seed our enemies' heartlands with fruits and nuts. Laboring without rest through the centuries of our kind, the kindly old saint decorates upon our stories, then hastens to deliver the great book daily to God's doorstep before dawn. Our Father takes each day's entries to read, to accompany his afternoon nap, to find amusement at the old Pope's paternal forgiveness, and to chuckle over the way of Peter's kindly telling of our stories. For Bedbox Media and Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin.